Hi, this is Taiwan Hippo Fam
and Purple Panda.
You're listening to the 8th episode of Musecast. So for this episode, we're going to have another recording from the Washington, D.C. Co-Convention. This time it's going to be Robert Koontz talking about where he works at Science Magazine.
So where I work, I do not make video games. I'm an editor at Science Magazine. And Science is, it's a science journal. So about 85% of it consists of scientific papers. And it's a peer-reviewed scientific journal, which means that when scientists submit papers to be published and other scientists can read them, the editors at Science send them out to other scientists who look at them and say, yeah, that's okay. And others, or they say, no, this doesn't, you know, this doesn't work. You can submit it to some other journal like Nature or something. Say, it's good enough to be published on the condition that you go back and you add this and that and the other thing and you take that out and take out that unreasonable assertion and you know, they demand changes. Okay, so the editors who do that are really smart and really knowledgeable, and that's not the part of the magazine I work for. I work in the news department, which is at the very beginning of the magazine. The news section, which actually reports on what's happening in science, and since most of our readers are scientists, that means we can report on the news in a different way from the daily newspapers. For one thing, we can use bigger words than they can. We can use words like entropy, and we don't have to go in and spend a paragraph explaining what that is. We can sort of figure that our scientists probably know what it is. They don't need a whole lot. So it's also another thing that we can do is we can report on things that interest scientists and probably nobody else, like, you know, how much money scientists are making nowadays, and you know, what their job offer prospects are and things like that. And we report on research results. So it's really an interesting place to work because I get to find out what happens before anything else happens, you know, before anybody else finds out about it, because the newspapers often find out about it from us. And one of the things that we sort of take into consideration, well, a couple of things. When we're trying to decide what goes in and what doesn't, one thing, we're weekly, you know, and so we operate on a weekly schedule. We come out on Friday, and we go online on Thursday. So that means that when you're in the news department, you're always kind of working a week or two ahead. And so, like right now, today we're working on the August 17th issue. So we hear about something that's happening. It'll be, usually when you're in the news business, you think something needs to have a peg. Something has to happen in order for it to go into the news section. Somebody has to publish a paper, somebody has to give a talk at a meeting, you know. And we can't just put something down, this is interesting, we'll put it down. If nothing really happens, then we can't do it. But we also have to make a little calculation. We have to think, is this something that, you know, that everybody on Earth is going to report before we do? If it's going to be in the daily papers before we can get to it, then we probably will just skip it. Like somebody discovers life on Mars. We'd have to think really hard about how we reported that, because we just know the next day it's going to be major headlines in all the newspapers in the world, it's going to be on the TV stations. And if then 10 days later we come out and we report the same story, we just look really lame.
So you have to skip that story?
Well, we might skip it and just sort of say, they'll already have read about it other places. Or we'll do what we call a second day story, which means that we will try and dig into things that the newspapers won't get. We'll try to look into, you know, aspects of it that probably people won't have read other places. So we'll get really, really smart scientists to comment on it. Or we'll sort of figure out, okay, what do they do next? How are they going to verify this? Or what does it mean? Or something, you know. What kind of life is it? They haven't discovered life on Mars yet. That is not in the August 17th issue. As of now, the news section closes on Monday. There's still time for it to happen. But it hasn't happened yet. So I'm a news editor. People ask me what editors do. I tell them, we sit around with our feet on the desk, and writers come to us and say, I've got this story, and we say, okay. And then they bring the story in, and we look at it, and we say, okay. And then it's a really great job. It's a little more involved than that. Roseanne is an editor, too.
Yeah, that's basically it.
You're an editor.
You just have to have really good writers.
If you have really good writers, then your job is kind of good. But Roseanne's an editor at Stanford Medicine.
At the magazine for Stanford Medical School. It only comes out three times a year. But I'm the only editor.
I'm not the only editor at Science. So the news department has a staff of about 3 dozen. There might be about 30 or 40 of us. It's hard to keep track because it depends on who we count.
Wow, that's huge.
And the editors are divided up by geeks. Might be it is physical sciences, which means I get rocks and planets and mathematics and galaxies and stars. And I get the dinosaurs, too, the fossils, because they used to be alive, but they're not alive anymore. They're rocks now, so I get them. So that's really my specialty, and that's really worked out well for the question and answer column at Muse, because Roseanne works for Stanford Medical School, so she gets to do all the stuff that breathes and bleeds and you know, kind of icky and wet. And I get the dry stuff. And if you look back through the columns, that's pretty much how we've divided it up.
But for once in a while,
kind of
have a change of pace.
Yeah.
So this is why you're going to be so cavalier about the life on Mars thing. That wouldn't be in your bailiwick anyway, Roseanne. Would have to sweat.
Well, on the one hand, it's life. On the other hand, it's Mars. So the biology editors and I might actually wind up having a little fist fight about that one, you know. Or we might divide it up. You know. I mean, that would be such a huge story.
I think you'd figure out a way of covering it, even if the newspapers had all done it the day before.
Yeah, actually, we have that story written already. You know, for when it happens, we're waiting for that life on Mars. We'll just fill in the blanks, you know, when it happens. But, you know, it's interesting. I guess one thing that might interest you to know, and I'm not going to talk about this as long as Bob did because I don't have as much to say, and I know that you want to move around and see some stuff, and there's some stuff we have to show you. One of the things that we have to decide is what doesn't go into the news section. And since we've only got about 15 pages an issue, and we're always doing sort of like little calculations. So one news story is equal to 1.5 to 2 columns, 3 columns per page, 15 columns per issue. Then we have the features that come after the news stories. We count them by the pages. They're usually about 2 pages long. You know, so we're always trying to make things fit, and we cut things to fit. And we cut prose like cloth. Mm-hmm. Those of you who are writing on the blog, and you have infinite amounts of space to work with, I mean, that's such a luxury, because we have to squeeze everything in. And if something doesn't fit, either we toss it out, or we find a way to tell it shorter. You know, we say it in fewer words. We're always doing that. We're condensing. We're, you know, mainly condensing rather than expanding. It's easier when a story comes in to make it shorter than longer, because to make it longer, you have to make stuff up. And we don't like doing that. We get into trouble, you know.
There at that peer-reviewed journal.
Especially in the last minute. So it's easier to cut stuff out than to put things in. And any of you who are going to journalism, you'll find that to be true. But we're always having to figure out what we're not going to publish in the news section. And, well, for example, you know, somebody discovers another moon of Jupiter. Is that news? I mean, is that something you think people would want to read about?
No.
How about another planet orbiting another, you know, around another star? You know, basically, I think that my threshold's pretty high for that sort of thing. Another moon of Jupiter, and Jupiter already has a couple of dozen of the moons. This one's just if we haven't seen it already, it's probably a little rock, you know, and you can barely see it, and it probably doesn't do anything very interesting. I'd say probably not, you know. Maybe we might put a little scorecard, number of moons on Jupiter. Exoplanets, same deal. When the first ones were discovered back in the 1990s, I was working in a magazine called The Sciences back in those days. I wrote this exuberant article. I said, you know, pop the champagne corks, you know, because, you know, I said, I'm not going to do handsprings, but I think I will open a bottle of champagne for this. And I was just so excited. They discovered planets around another star. And it was just so incredibly cool. No one had done that before. Now they've got about 240 of them, you know, and they discover new ones every week. And I see these, they issue their press releases and their announcements and things, and I just kind of yawn because, you know, ho-ho, another extraterrestrial planet. Now, right now what I'm waiting for is, they have to be really interesting in some way. Like, the first ones they spotted were the really big ones, you know, and the ones that are really close to their stars, because they spot them by noting the effects of the gravitational pull of the planet on the star. When the planet pulls on the star, orbiting around it, it makes the star wiggle. That changes the way that the light is distorted as it comes to Earth. So you get a little Doppler shift. When it comes toward us, you know, the light turns bluer. When it goes away, it turns redder. And so they can see this really fine effect, and they can find out a lot about the planet. So they got the big ones first, because they're the ones that pull hardest. They don't have any that are the size of Earth yet. Maybe they got one that's about that size, but that may be five times as big. When they find one that's the size of Earth, especially if they can, you know, kind of filter out the star's light and find out that it has water, and especially oxygen, you know, if it's Earth-like, then it goes into the news. But right now, just another big gas giant Jupiter. Yes?
Like you said, they should have a you know how we have the cat counter and dog counter?
No.
We got like a planet counter.
Yeah, that's not bad. I'm sure people do that. I'm sure you can go on
request
the
for new
that.
Planets.
Hmm?
Request for new planets.
Request for new planets?
Well, request for cat and dog articles.
That's true.
Not new planets.
Yes.
How do you maintain the right, the proper language, the proper, you know, to not be too, certainly you mentioned your scientists are readers, so you want it to, you can use words that wouldn't be in the newspaper, but you don't want it to be like a scientific paper either. You have to find a balance.
Exactly.
So
are you a science editor by any chance?
No, we have one question talking about Scientific American versus Science. You know, there's different periodicals are aimed for different levels, and how do you maintain that level? How do you decide what that level is, and how do you maintain it? Does it always be the same? I mean,
constant vigilance.
Okay.
Well, that's what editors do.
Okay, yeah, that's
in fact, that's one of the main things that editors do. We decide on how things should be treated, and if a writer comes in sounding too technical or something, we can send it back and say, write that again, you know, easier. Or we can just change it. If there's not much time, that's often what we'll do. We'll just go in and change something mercilessly. And the writer just has to take it because it's
you're
not the editor.
So you and the other editors have to sort of maintain that balance among yourselves, though, to kind of keep it consistent with the
magazine. Yeah, we know what we're shooting for, basically. I mean, we talk about it. That's one thing. The news section of Science isn't that different from the news section of Science News, or Scientific American, or Discover, or New Scientist. We're trying to keep things really understandable. That's because we kind of figure that the physicists will already have heard the physics news through their own channels, and the biologists will have heard the biology news through their channels. So it's the physicists who are reading the biology news, and the biologists are reading the physics news, so they're reading about stuff they don't really know all that much about, so we have to explain it. And so we can introduce basic scientific concepts a little bit, you know, more freely than we could if we were writing for somebody else. But we have to be really clear and conversational, and that's just how news is done. But the nice thing about working for Science Magazine as opposed to working for a newspaper is that we like science and we're allowed to report it, whereas a lot of newspaper editors just hate science and the people won't read it, and they want another story about Paris Hilton or something. If Paris Hilton ever decides to study astrophysics or something, then we'll report her.
Yes.
The guitarist for Queen, going back to get his PhD in astrophysics.
Yeah.
He's going to finish it.
Really?
And he just wrote a book.
I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
I think
she
get on the walk. I tried to get Butterfly Boucher, but she hasn't answered it yet.
Groundbreaking in every way.
Are all your writers in-house? People who write the articles?
No, our writers are all over the world.
Oh.
We have staff writers and we have freelance writers. Fewer freelance writers than we used to because we don't have as much money as we used to. We don't have advertising as much. So we have more staff writers. Because you can work them harder, you know? But I have writers, in fact, none of my regular writers are here in the Washington office right now. I've got one who lives in Detroit because his wife is a college professor there. I've got one who lives in the Pacific Northwest, in Oregon. We've got people in Europe, we've got people in Asia. Nowadays, stuff comes in by email, it doesn't really matter, you can be anywhere, you can still do it. So we have writers scattered all over the place.
And where do they get their material from?
Well, they get it from, I mean, it depends on what kind of material. I mean, for one thing, they talk to scientists a lot. They're just really, they got their feelers out, you know. They go to meetings, they read journals, they read online stuff, they read blogs, where scientists can really, you know, complain about stuff. Basically by just the same way that other people learn things, only we work a little harder at it and get it sooner.
To finish, we'll listen to an excerpt of Glassboro playing a Chopin farewell on the flute. Thanks for listening to MuseCast!